Afternoon is the not morning, and it's the not night. It's that precarious, wobbly rope bridge you have to get across between the two of them. The only thing for the afternoon is to get through it, just get across it, whatever way you can. Morning is certain. If you're lucky, night is too. And maybe in some ways, no matter how much of a hames you make of the afternoon, if you're lucky, you'll have evening to cling on to sooner or later.
Darkness at noon, lazing on a sunny afternoon, death in the afternoon, afternoon delight. In the first episode of Morning, Noon and Night, we woke up, we stretched and shook off the world of dreams. We embraced the light of a new morning and we walked to school. Last week, we also heard Yvonne Cullen read poems and stories for us as we greeted the new day. Yvonne is a poet in her own right, and I asked her to help make sense of what can be, for me at least, a tricky part of the day. You're a poet, you're a teacher, you're a writer. What do afternoons mean for you in terms of your creativity?
I'd wake up asking myself, what part of my creative work am I able for today? By lunchtime, hopefully, I'll have a fair amount of that done. I will leave space in the afternoon without even realising I'm doing it. I probably don't push myself as hard in the afternoon because I know I have less energy. And because of that, I probably have a kind of a more relaxed state of mind, which allows me to notice things. It allows little flukes of new ideas to maybe kind of float into my mind. As a freelancer, the first word I'd use for afternoon, really, is empty.
I really understand how in the freelance world you mightn't have jobs coming in, you mightn't have an income at the end of the month. The afternoon is riddled sometimes with uncertainty and doubt about your own work too. Am I doing enough? Am I working hard enough? And I think that this is more common now in Ireland as more and more people are self-employed and freelancing.
With more and more of us in what you'd call the gig economy, there are probably more people than ever before who have that relationship with this part of the day where it's up to you to fill it. The freedom can be marvellous. It's an amazing resource, the afternoon, because it's a stretch of time where, if you use it properly, you can create all sorts of other opportunities for yourself.
There might be people listening to this who every afternoon have to pick up their kids from school, or who are in an office looking at the clock waiting for 5 o'clock, or maybe farmers who are about to go out for the evening milking. And they might be wondering, what on earth are we talking about? But I suspect even for them, there's a lull in the afternoon.
I think it's probably simply kind of circadian. You know, you've been awake a certain number of hours. There is a bit of a slump. Afternoon is definitely a sort of a lapsing, lulling time. I think no matter what you do, it's the time when you are watching the clock, it's the time you have to get through.
You just practice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just practicing.
Yeah. Which one are we all doing?
To help us get through it, the women of Landless sing a couple of verses from A Hymn to Noon by Thomas Parnell.
Parnell?
Yeah. The sun is swiftly mounted high. It glitters in the southern sky. Its beams with force and glory beam. And fruitful earth is
An Elizabethan Day by Nicholas Breton. It is now the 12th hour. The sun is at his height and the middle of the day. The first course is served in and the second ready to follow. The dishes have been read over. The wine begins to be called for. Talk passeth away the time, and when the stomachs are full, discourses grow dull and heavy. The market is done, the exchange broke up, and the lawyers at dinner. The shopmen keep their shops, and their servants go to dinner. The ploughman now is at the bottom of his dish, and the labourer draws his dinner out of his bag. The beasts of the field take rest after their feed, and the rabbit will scarce peep out of her burrow. The hare sits close asleep in her mews. In brief, I hold it, the stomach's pleasure and the spirit's weariness. Farewell.
That old-fashioned idea of dinner in the middle of the day still appeals to me, even if the talk was dull and heavy. I usually eat my lunch at my desk in front of my computer. The days of the long lunch are well over. One man, Paddy Rice, has seen his fair share of them. He worked at Beaufield Mews restaurant in Dublin for 5 decades until it closed last year.
You didn't see this in the Times, no?
No.
If you can see it, that's me now, just before it closed.
While it's been in the family since the 1930s, it's been hugely important to head waiter Paddy Rice, who has been with the family for almost half a century.
It was an old stables converted, right? And it was an old world restaurant. Smoked salmon, pate, melon, tureen, goat cheese salad, pork, beef, chicken, salmon, vegetarian, cod.
What year did you start in the restaurant?
In July 68.
And you never left it?
Never left it. I was out 2 weeks in 50 years, which had an injury playing football. That was the only time I was ever out of work. Lunch would start at 12:30 and go on till 4 or 5 o'clock. But people would be there till 7 or 9 at night, sipping their wine.
And so during the Celtic Tiger years then, were there big, long lunches?
There were big, long lunches. People never checked their bills, just never ending. And by God, they go on for till 6 o'clock and 7 o'clock in the evening. Just keep spending and spending. But then when the recession came, they went, tightened their belt, the law changed.
This is a tale that never will tire. This is the song without end.
Can you think of why maybe now we're not enjoying long lunches like we used to once upon a time?
Yeah, well, people don't have the time anymore. It's all the culture has changed, you know. So most people now are eating at their desks and all that. Do you know what I mean? And sparkling water. You don't see much alcohol being used during lunch times at all.
Love is a
lot of people, young people, in bed to work. You don't have much time to sit back and relax. Do you know what I mean? We don't have time for one another, I think. That's what's wrong. It's just rush, 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 rush.
What kind of a skill and talent should a waiter have?
To know what a person wants and what way you approach them. And a lot of people that knew me in the Beaufield Mews, that they would be amazed that I'd know their names, and they wouldn't be there for 12 months or that, you know. And I remember what drink they had or whatever bottle of wine they had, you know what I mean? People said, you make a great politician. you got the gift of the gab and all that, you know what I mean? A soul and a bone would be born at the table, would be born by the waiter at the table, which is a skill in itself, you know what I mean? You take the bone out in front of the person and they're amazed by it, how you can do that. In front of a person, it's different than going in the background and doing a type of thing, but you have to get it right.
There's an element of theatre then to your job.
There is actually, yeah.
You're an impresario, welcoming people.
Welcoming people and showing off your skills in front of them. And I enjoy that, you know, type of thing, yeah.
So you've been doing it for 53 years in one place.
Right.
And you were working before that. And you're still working now part-time in a restaurant.
Part-time, yeah.
Will you ever stop?
As an old saying, you stop, you drop. That's the way I look at it, yeah.
The last long lunch I had was recently enough in Paris. An aperitif, a carafe of wine, a digestif, and of course some delicious food. The writer, Jan Carson, was also in Paris at the same time. Unlike me, she was busy working there, researching and writing. She broke her routine to spend an afternoon with me at the Jardin du Luxembourg, a large, busy park in the 6th District.
Do you know, I think it's hilarious in Paris how many people actually wear red berets. And, like, lots of them should have better sense.
What does the red beret mean?
You know, like I've actually seen people at the Eiffel Tower in a black and white stripy jumper with a red beret. Like, I don't know whether they think they look authentically French or... It's just like they got like tourist written all over them. I'm here for a month, staying in Paris on a wee residency. I'm staying at the Irish College, or if my French was a little bit better, I would say the Centre Culturel Irlandais, but my French is awful. I speak French with a really thick Ballymena accent.
Why have you suggested the Jardin du Luxembourg then as a place for us to think and talk about the afternoon?
I guess writing is quite a lonely, solitary pursuit, and you're often sat in a quite sterile room looking at a wall, trying to be creative. But I think there's also something about the liminal kind of nature of an afternoon. You know, it's not the start of the day, it's not the end of the day, it's still ripe with possibility. You know, as writers, we have good writing days and bad writing days. And by 2 o'clock, everything hasn't gone to pieces yet. It's still redeemable. Afternoons are when I walk out ideas. I do think there's something about physical movement and the creative process for a writer. Even the sound of your footsteps. We're in the Jardin du Luxembourg that has that sort of strange gravelly kind of sand everywhere you get in Parisian parks. There's a sound to how you walk here. It's different from when you walk in a forest or a beach. If I was at home, I'd be pounding the streets of East Belfast in a big anorak. In Paris, it's a little bit more inspiring to get out and walk amongst these beautiful buildings and gorgeous gardens and even just look at the people. There's a guy walking past me now in the most interesting spandex leggings. So you never know when you come out in Paris what you're going to see.
Maybe he's a writer too and doing an afternoon walk.
That would be a kind way of looking at those leggings.
It's another familiar sight of Paris. A man zipping up there just in the corner.
I thought you were going to say a rat, because I keep seeing rats in here.
There's loads of rats in Paris.
I don't know if you've seen around the Eiffel Tower, there's loads of signs about not leaving food scraps around because they feed the rats.
We have seen 3 rats since we came just 2 days ago.
I mean, it's paradise for rats because people are eating in the street all the time and dropping things. They're probably the fattest rats in Europe. So last year, a number of Irish writers were asked by the Irish Studies Network to write a short piece about their writing process. And I decided to write a short story. It's based around a quote from Patricia Highsmith, the novelist. She said that ideas came to her like birds in the corner of her eye. And I loved that. And I wrote a short story about a girl who's being pursued by a bird that she can't actually catch fully in her view. And it follows her around all day. All day, she's distracted by the thought of it. She sits at her desk, incapable of concentrating on her spreadsheets. She's sure she can see red birds blurring backwards and forwards above the office skylight, but she isn't paid to watch birds. She is paid to type numbers into spreadsheets, to add these numbers up and occasionally multiply one number by another, which is more difficult and requires concentration. She rearranges the biros in her drawer and the paper clips too. She diddles little red birds across a whole rack of post-it notes, and when the boss drops by to ask how the accounts are going, She snaps and says, I'm working as fast as I can. I've only got two hands. The boss says she should take a break. Go outside, get some air. She takes a half-hour break from her desk. She walks across the street to the park next to Tesco's. The thing flickers along next to her. In the park, she lies down under a tree. She sets her alarm for 25 minutes. Thinking about the thing has sapped all her energy. She's almost immediately asleep. She dreams of red birds. Red birds flying. Red birds sitting on windowsills. Red birds pecking at little crumbs they find scattered beside litter bins and downtown benches. She wakes suddenly when the alarm goes off. And for a moment, continues to see red birds fluttering overhead. So one of the things that I love to do towards the end of the afternoon is to spend some time reading. It's such a great way to get out of your own head and into someone else's. The thing that no one talks about on a residency is how much quiet time you have. You can go for days without hearing anything but your own voice, and you become very much all up in your own head. And so to slide into Edna O'Brien's head or Anne Enright's head for an hour is kind of refreshing and much needed. Sometimes, don't tell anyone this, but I'll get into bed with a book and desperately try not to fall asleep. But there's something very sort of luxurious, like you're spoiling yourself when you go to bed for an hour with a book in the afternoon. I'm just thinking there's another pair of fantastic leggings walking past. I think we might be in Jardin du Luxembourg on weird legging day.
Jane Clarke's second collection of poems, When the Tree Falls, was published last year by Blood Axe Books. The poems document the time of her father's final illness, the death of a close friend, as well as a time of recent social changes in Ireland. I met Jane at the Poetry Ireland building on Parnell Square in Dublin, and she chose two poems to read for this episode of Morning, Noon and Night. Both poems are set on bright, sunny days, but not entirely cloudless days, as she explained to me.
In the 4 years that I was writing this, there was a very important referendum, and that was to repeal the Eighth Amendment. And we live in Glenmalure, and the polling station is just at the end of our road, and it's in this old schoolhouse. And I, you know, when we went to vote that day, I suppose I had no idea what the vote would be like in that, you know, in Glenmalure, this very rural area, very traditional in many ways. And I noted a kind of a sensitivity amongst people, because I think there was an awareness that neighbours might feel very differently. There were very strong feelings, but I noted the kind of respect for each other. There were people, you know, who I knew who had worked so hard over many, many years, over 30 years, to get to this day where this issue of women's rights really would at last be dealt with in a much more mature way. But I also think there was that sensitivity that there were people who this was so difficult for, to see this change. And I think that was a greater maturity in Irish society that allowed for both of those to coexist, the hope and also the concerns for other people as well. Polling station, May 25th, 2018. In the queue up to the door of the schoolhouse, neighbours welcome sunshine after the wettest of wet winters. Spirits lift at the sight of fields drying out, grass thickening, calves thriving, unstoppable growth. There's talk of young ones speeding home to vote, swallows back to the barn. No one asks anyone where they'll place their ex. Every family has stories left like ploughs and harrows among thistles behind the sheds.
What struck me when I read the poems first was that you have a great eye for nature. So where did that come about?
Well, I grew up on this farm in County Roscommon, but I wouldn't have been aware of how much nature meant to me actually until I started to write poetry. I started in my 40s, and when I wrote, the imagery that came to me was of, you know, the farms and the hedges and the lakes and rivers of Roscommon, but also of Wicklow. I live in Lemalure in County Wicklow, so, you know, I was writing in Wicklow with memories of the nature around me as a child. And the more I wrote, the more I learnt and became more and more aware of how much it had shaped my kind of imaginative landscape, the external.
You're going to read a poem called Aftergrass. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, this poem was written in the summer of 2018, in July, when we were having this marvellous weather, this heat wave, which we were enjoying. I think everybody in Ireland was just loving it. And there was a sense of threat and fear about why we were having this, you know, so there was the threat of climate chaos whilst we were also enjoying it. And it was 18 months after my father had died, and I suppose I was thinking about how much he loved the sun, because of course in the summer it was great for getting the hay made, and he just absolutely loved it. And so there was that sense of wanting to share with him both the wonder of this beautiful heat wave, but also the concern behind it. And that's where the poem came from. Aftergrass. Laughs full before the end of June. Stoat kits playing in the aftergrass. Cattle clustered in dusty circles among thickets of hazel and ash. Little egrets sentinel still in shallows more shallow than we've ever seen. I sit by my father and tell him the sun has scorched every blade of grass. His headstone's not up, but the wording's agreed.
Aftergrass is just 12 lines long, and in it we see stoat kits, cattle, hazel, ash, little egrets, and grass. The writer Tom McCochrane also brings the natural world to life in the pages of his series of books about foxes, which began with Run with the Wind. When I read his stories as a child, they opened my eyes to an amazing variety of flowers, trees, and birds. But the writing was never sentimental. The foxes were targets of hunters, dogs, hunger, and cold weather. In this short reading, it's a bitterly cold afternoon, and McCochrane sketches a beautiful wintry landscape, full of life and colour.
Cold east wind blew in across the meadows, stirring the clumps of withered grass that rose above the patches of crisp snow. It whistled through the leafless trees at the top of the rise and ruffled the feathers of a rook that still preferred the topmost branches to a more friendly perch farther down. In the hedgerow beneath, a single robin bared his red breast to the wind for a moment before turning tail and hopping off about his business. The wind curled through the dead leaves behind the hedge and around the foot of the trees, and now and then it flicked up a leaf and impaled it on a scraggy hawthorn branch or on a strand of barbed wire. For a moment, a yellowhammer flitted through a clump of gorse, lending a flash of colour to a bush that wouldn't flower more fully until the approach of Easter. Then, sensing that the gorse was already occupied, it beat a hasty retreat. The soft belly of the young dog fox rose and fell as he lay in the undergrowth. His legs were wet and muddy, for he had travelled far, and each panted breath misted warmly for a moment before being taken away by the cold wind. There was a lean, hungry look about him, a look not accounted for by his lack of years. It had been a hard year, and it was getting harder.
His black ears twitched to every sound, and the sharp vertical pupils of his eyes missed nothing as he looked across the bleak, wintry landscape.
O'Brien Press published all of Tom McCochrane's Run with the Wind series, and he told me that the books are now translated into 20 languages. In her poem, Afternoon on a Hill, Edna St. Vincent Millay says she will look at 100 flowers and not pick one. For her, the afternoon is the perfect time to be still and watch the natural world around her with what she calls quiet eyes.
I will be the gladdest thing under the sun. I will touch 100 flowers and not pick one. I will look at cliffs and clouds with quiet eyes. Watch the wind bow down the grass and the grass rise. And when lights begin to show up from the town, I will mark which must be mine and then start down.
Afternoon on a Hill is one of the texts which the singers Landless have lent their airs to for this episode of Morning, Noon and Night.
I will be the gladdest thing under the sun. I will touch 100 flowers and not pick one. I will look at cliffs and clouds with quiet eyes. Watch the wind burn down the grass and the grass rise. And when lights begin to show up from the town, I will mark which must be mine and then start down.
The poem, and now the song, inspired me to spend an afternoon on a hill in County Wicklow with the botanist Cara Daly. I'm not a plant expert, but as we walked along the coast from Bray to Greystones, Cara convinced me that there are many benefits in taking a little time out of an afternoon to get to know the flowers beneath your feet. This is a walk just outside Greystones, and it's similar to walks all over Ireland, outside towns and villages, and we're not in the wild countryside, we're not up a mountain, we're not in the bogs. And what we're going to see here is just some very common plants hiding in plain sight of us, really.
Sometimes it pays to slow down a little bit because you can pass by some little gems there at your feet. So there's lots of a beautiful red flower here. It's called red valerian. And you might see it growing out of the wall tops in cities and towns. But it's growing quite profusely here along the Bray to Greystones coastal path.
You're a farmer's daughter, aren't you?
I am. I was born and raised in County Meath on a dairy farm just outside of Kells. I suppose I've always had a great interest in the outdoors, and I suppose there wasn't a lot to do, but we made our own fun when we were kids. One of my jobs, you know, we all had chores in the farm, one of my jobs would be to help out in the garden and do a bit of weeding. It was amazing, you know, to see the long roots and then the short little fibrous roots. And it was almost like unearthing treasure from the earth, you know.
We're passing a lot of these purple ones here, Cara. I actually don't recognise them at all.
Yeah, Regan, these are Rose Bay willow herb. You see them all over the hedgerows of Ireland, all during the summer, and they have a beautiful, showy purple flower.
And they're quite tall.
They are, they get very tall. They can be up to 7 or 8 feet tall in some cases.
Really?
Yeah, when you look at a flower first, its anatomy can give away a lot about it. So, for instance, this willow herb, its flowers and petals are purple, but at the back of the flower, they're joined together into a tube. And you can nearly bet your bottom dollar this type of a flower is pollinated by something like a butterfly, which is a very long tongue called a proboscis. And the butterfly can reach its tongue down to the end of that tube and get its nectar reward. When you look at the architecture of a flower, they're amazing, really, you know. But look down here, Regan, look at the little shield bug.
Oh, yeah. What's he doing?
he looks like he's just chilling out there. And so sometimes, you know, when you look at flowers and plants, you see lots of little other little insect gems hanging around. Plants require insects to pollinate their seeds to carry on the next generation. So there's a real interdependability between plants and flora.
I will be the gladdest thing under the sun.
Oh, this is a lovely view now of the sea.
It's beautiful.
And is that Greystones over there?
That's Greystones. Yeah, we've walked a fair bit, haven't we?
I think we have.
But after a busy week, don't you feel like the worries of the week are just melting away?
Do botanists tend to walk with their heads cast down as if they're depressed?
We do. You can spot a botanist from about a quarter of a mile away. They're usually looking at their feet. The posture wouldn't be the best.
I will touch 100 flowers and not pick one.
Oh, look, Carrie, you just walked on something there that I wanted to ask you about.
Oh, the one time I wasn't looking at my feet. So this beautiful little diminutive plant is Devil's Bit Scabious. It's a beautiful, got blue petals, they're real feathery. It has a tiara of green sepals on the back, and then there's a beautiful, small, compact little rosette of leaves at the back.
So you're a teacher to fresher students and other students in Waterford, and you teach plant science. And I'm wondering if there's some surprise element for the students that come in and are introduced to this topic.
Yeah, there is, because the first lecture that I deliberately have with all my students is a lecture on something called plant blindness. So I accuse them all of being plant blind. I usually put up a photograph of a lioness sitting in a tree, and I'll ask them to say what do they see in the photograph, and they'll say it's a lion or a lioness, car, and I'll say, yeah, but you don't realise that it's sitting in a sausage tree. When I point it out, they'll see that the fruit of this tree is about a half metre long pod that is nearly hitting the lion on the head, and they realise that, yeah, maybe they actually don't notice the plants around them. They sort of take them for granted a little bit.
Is there an environmental benefit to understanding and knowing the names of plants that are on your regular walk?
Oh, there is, because when you see a stranger on the street, just say you're on your daily commute and you see a stranger at the Dart station or at the bus stop for months, years, but then someday you learn their name and you feel like you're a lot closer to them, don't you? So when you get to identify a plant, even by its common name, you feel like you know it better, like you respect it better, and crucially that you've added value to it. You know, we're sitting here on a beautiful, next to a stone wall looking out along the sea, and there's probably about 150 species around us. They feel like old friends. Like, you might go for a walk on your own, but you never really feel like you're alone. And it makes me feel, without being really hippy-dippy, I really feel part of the environment and part of the earth when I can actually, you know, nod my head and say, you know, hello, foxglove rosette.
There's a pause in the day. Afternoon brings a moment of stillness, maybe idleness. This is a time when things can happen. I spoke to Yvonne Cullen about some famous afternoons in literature, and she began our conversation by reading the opening lines of Great Expectations by Charles Dickens.
Ours was the marsh country, down by the river. My first, most vivid and broad impression of the identity of things seems to me to have been gained
on a memorable raw afternoon towards evening. At such a time, I found out for certain that this bleak place, overgrown with nettles, was the churchyard, and that the dark, flat wilderness beyond the churchyard, intersected with dikes and mounds and gates, with scattered cattle feeding on it, was the marshes, and that the low, leaden line beyond was the river, and that the distant, savage lair from which the wind was rushing was the sea, and that the small bundle of shivers growing afraid of it all and beginning to cry was Pip. "Hold your noise!" cried a terrible voice as a man started up from among the graves at the side of the church porch. "Keep still, you little devil, or I'll cut your throat." A fearful man, all in coarse grey, with a great iron on his leg. A man with no hat, and with broken shoes, and with an old rag tied round his head. A man who had been soaked in water and smothered in mud and lamed by stones and cut by flints and stung by nettles and torn by briars, who limped and shivered and glared and growled and whose teeth chattered in his head as he seized me by the chin. If you think about the opening of Great Expectations, if Pip had been sitting in happily by the fire in his sister's living room, Mrs. Gargery's living room, or hanging out with Joe in the forge, being helpful, being useful, there wouldn't have been a book. It's because he was arsing around in the graveyard on a raw afternoon towards evening that all the bother began.
Magwitch would never have been in a graveyard first thing in the morning because it just wouldn't have been good literature.
Yeah, well, you need that kind of almost crepuscular time of day where things are gloomy, the light is falling, there's more chance of something lurking in the shadows. That's just the right match for your curiosity and boredom.
I think more than morning and night, afternoon is something that happens to children. And the reason why I say that is because they've finished school. Sometimes their parents are still working. There's a long stretch until dinner time or tea time. It's full of boredom. It's also the time when things can happen to them.
Yes, I would definitely remember the stretch between school and your tea and a sense, Mother God, what am I going to do with these hours? Of course, a bit of homework might fall in there, a bit of piano practicing, that sort of thing. But it has less rules attached to it. It is the not school time, not evening. You might not know what could happen.
And in children's literature, things often do happen. And we're surrounded here in your house by lots of beautiful old editions of children's books. And one of the books we've got here is Alice in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll. And the very opening of the book takes place in the afternoon.
I think it's only in the afternoon that you might find the spare time on your hands and find what fiction would call a call to adventure. I think you need to be bored to find your way down a magical rabbit hole after a white rabbit. Alice was beginning to get very tired of sitting by her sister on the bank and of having nothing to do. Once or twice she had peeped into the book her sister was reading, but it had no pictures or conversations in it. And what is the use of a book, thought Alice, without pictures or conversations? So she was considering in her own mind, as well as she could, for the hot day made her feel very sleepy and stupid, whether the pleasure of making a daisy chain would be worth the trouble of getting up and picking the daisies. When suddenly a white rabbit with pink eyes ran close by her. There was nothing so very remarkable in that, nor did Alice think it so very much out of the way to hear the rabbit say to itself, oh dear, I shall be late. When she thought it over afterwards, it occurred to her that she ought to have wondered at this, but at the time, it all seemed quite natural. But when the rabbit actually took a watch out of its waistcoat pocket and looked at it, and then hurried on, Alice started to her feet, for it flashed across her mind that she had never before seen a rabbit with either a waistcoat pocket or a watch to take out of it. And burning with curiosity, she ran across the field after it, and fortunately was just in time to see it pop down a large rabbit hole under the hedge. In another moment, down went Alice after it, never once considering how in the world she was to get out again.
Budapest, August 2004. I've opened the window in the kitchen of my airless apartment. There's no breeze. Instead, the sounds of Budapest drift in over the courtyard. Church bells, birdsong, traffic as heavy as the heat of this summer afternoon. He's very late. I'm beginning to think that he mightn't come. He hasn't got a phone, so there's no way of finding out. I'll just have to wait. For Gábor. That's his name. If he doesn't come, I'll leave the apartment. I've no classes to teach. No one takes English lessons in August. I've got nothing to do. If Gábor doesn't come, I'll walk to the shop for a bottle of cold beer. And then sit in the square with the basketball court and drink my beer on a bench in the shade. His English isn't good, and my Hungarian is worse. Last time was a bit of a struggle. But I understand you, he said. If Gábor doesn't come, I'll walk to the river, to the Turkish baths. I'll take off my clothes there and find a cold stone of my own to lie on. The last time Gábor arrived with slices of watermelon. Görög dinje. I'll teach you Hungarian, he said. The last time Gábor gently lowered the wooden shutters over the open windows. We turned our backs to the city, the dust and the noise. The last time he told me that life in Hungary is very hard and maybe he'd move to Ireland. He said this with a grin as wide as the watermelon. A grin as wide as the one slant of sun which crossed the bedroom floor to light his bare shoulder. That was the last time. That was the first time. This series is looking at our experience of the everyday, and it celebrates much of what we might take for granted. And this can include everyday objects we might never think about until, over the course of our life, they take on a more significant meaning. Often this happens when the person we associate with them is no longer with us. For example, a tatty but treasured denim jacket, hanging up in the shed.
It was second hand, you know. I bought it for €3 in a charity shop. And he absolutely adored it. For round the farm now, you know. Not for going to town. Lovely denim. It'll be here after me.
Pat O'Donovan lived together with her husband, Gerard, in their West Cork farm until his sudden death in 2014. Pat is my aunt, and I've many questions about how the everyday is turned upside down by grief. How long are the sheds built? I remember them when they were old barns with swallows flying in and out of them.
That was the summer Gerard died, yeah. 2014. Got finished in September. That's what got to me about that, Regan, because he had wanted one for so long and I had wanted one. And he always said, I'll only do it if I can do a decent one.
That was hard that he couldn't enjoy this because he would have lived here.
And look, Regan, the Reader's Digest, that's what he had been reading. It was open on that. That's November.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. And it was open on that page. Jokes page,
yeah,
of course.
Yeah, of course, yeah. You couldn't make it up, yeah. So it's there since, and I don't close it. So
I didn't know that, Pat.
When you'd say, what would I be holding on to, you know? That's, yeah.
That's funny that that's open at the jokes page.
Yeah. And that's how I found it. Whenever I found it after, I can't remember.
I asked Pat if she'd talk to me for this series about how losing her husband changed her relationship to the night, but she said that it was the afternoon, which she found and still finds the hardest part of the day.
Afternoon or early evening, I suppose. Rather than the actual nights, I sit down, I watch some television. It's daytime. It's, you know, but he was always there when I came from work almost, and he'd probably be finished up what he was doing, so he would say, go on, throw on your tracksuit. go for a walk around and go around the bog. The bog wasn't always there for walking, but I mean, I go out the field now because I still like it and I have to, but I don't get excited about it. Like, I have to go with the dogs anyway, you know, so.
Gerard was obviously very fond of the dogs, and he had packs of dogs for as long as I've known him.
Yeah.
And one of his dogs is still with us.
Yeah, Sheba, yeah. He got Sheba in 2013. Yeah, so he had her like for a year. That was so awful. Watching her, you know, after, yeah.
What was she like?
Oh, she was really trying to come into the house, you know, because she couldn't believe where it was, like. Because he wasn't going to work, he wasn't missing. I don't know how dogs are like, but for a good long time, I'd say she couldn't just accept that he wasn't showing, you know. That's, yeah.
And guess what you're getting tonight? Your supper time. Getting an egg.
Hmm? The fact that it's out of date is neither here nor there. Not for a dog. So Zach is first, of course. Little Zach.
What breed is Zach? Jack Russell.
Jack Russell.
And the two of them love each other.
Oh, absolutely. He's kind of the boss-like, really. And she doesn't know how big she is. She has no idea that she's an Alsatian, you know. Now, Zach's nuts have been soaked. I think he found it a bit slow to eat the hard nuts. So I started soaking them.
I thought soaking wasn't the worst thing that happened to Zach's nuts.
You're right, sometimes they can just disappear. It was only like 4 months or so when the cattle had to go, and there were times they were definitely more important than I was, like, you know. Like, he just would care for them so well, like, he loved them to bits. And if he had a sick one or anything, like, he'd be so upset for the animal, like.
So when he died then, you were obviously responsible for the business, and at one stage you had to make the decision to sell the cattle, and I imagine that was hard.
I knew I couldn't keep them, you know. Yeah, it was very hard, really. It broke my heart, yeah. It was reality. It had to be done, you know, so.
And what, did you go down to the mart?
I did. I went down to the mart with Paula. She offered her company, really, with me, and
she's a neighbour.
She just came as for moral support. It was very, very emotional. That was probably one of the worst days in my life.
Really?
And I say that as opposed to the day he died, because I don't, you know, you couldn't imagine that day being bad or good. It was just, I looked down and saw one of my own cows and I just cracked up. Yeah, I got through it, but it was horrible. Like, it was really, really horrible.
Did you talk to Gerard that day?
Yeah, I did. I mean, definitely. Just said, I hope they make what you'd have expected them to make and whatever, you know.
And what do you think he would have said to you that day?
I don't know. I often think that he'd probably be kind of proud of me in a way that I handle things, you know. I was strong behind the tears, like, you know. Yeah. So, and I still am, Regan. I mean, you're going to see that. I'm strong, like, so much a lot of the time, aren't I?
From A Suite for North Great George's Street. And the bird shit Oham, reflected in a flat roof's familiar puddle, told me how much I could love. And every red brick in this view from a window. Under the river of the afternoon, all was perfect as a model. All my loves were in that view. Nesting love, warm wood or wicker lit behind windows. And love for you, shadow of an almost invisible bird, beating now like a heart here up a wall. Now a girl swung in at an entryway in yellow satin.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Morning, Noon and Night. Thanks to the contributors, Yvonne Cullen, Paddy Rice, Jan Carson, Jane Clark, Cara Daly and Pat O'Donovan. And thanks to our reader David O'Mara and also to Tom McCochrane. Landless sang two songs especially for this episode, and we'll hear more from them in the next programme when we'll travel across the night with newborn babies, hags, little nuns, and hooting owls. See you next week. Noon, the second episode of the series Morning, Noon and Night, was presented and produced by Regan Hutchins for RTE Lyric FM. The entire series is available to podcast from RTE Podcasts and from the usual podcast providers. Search for the Lyric Feature Podcast. We welcome your comments by email features.lyricfm@rte.ie.